Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast Extras. In this episode, we talk about Windows 10, an S10, and upgrading to an X99. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McCain. Darren, some people might be wondering why we didn't release an extra last month.
Well, that is a good question.
And while scheduling and people being out of town and stuff like that really actually was the reason, I'm going to blame it on Windows 10.
Let's do.
So on July 29th, Microsoft released the basically Windows 8.2 or Windows 10.
A disruptive force in the marketplace, one might say.
And fixed a lot of stuff.
Yes, they did. And it was released globally on the same day, which in itself is a major feat. Mm-hmm. And might be some of the reason that people haven't upgraded yet.
So there was a free upgrade little icon for people that had legit copies of Windows 7, Windows 8, and 8.1.
Right.
Allowing you to reserve a spot to upgrade to Windows 10 for free.
So what that did was that put you in the queue, essentially, because they expected large server demand. So unlike, say, EA, for example, they attempted to throttle their bandwidth by providing you with a date and time where you would get the full Windows experience. But as enthusiasts, what did we do?
We went out to Microsoft's website and found the upgrade tool that you downloaded, and then it would pull down all the bits and allow you to either make a bootable USB drive or an ISO image for a DVD.
That's right. Bandwidth be damned. I'm not waiting for my copy of Windows 10.
But when you pull it down on a device like that, you can go around to all of your machines and upgrade them.
That's right. Now, it wasn't entirely a problem-free experience, at least for me.
Well, the podcast machine, the one that I special built so that we can record the podcast and have like fast compressor response time, is running Windows 10.
So we're on a Windows 10 machine right now. And in fact, I am looking at my notes on a Surface Pro that's running Windows 10 right now also.
Yeah. So it so far has worked. The podcast machine upgraded in, I would say, 30 minutes. So it was like super smooth, but there wasn't that much stuff on it. I mean, it's basically just the tools we use for recording the podcast.
So I didn't get around to grabbing my ISO copy, which I put on a USB 3 stick. Mm-hmm. 3 gigs required. It will wipe your stick, by the way, but it's definitely faster. But I didn't get around to it until about 9 or 10 o'clock that night. And by then, the Windows servers were filling the hammer.
Was it slow?
It was like a DDoS, man. It took me over an hour to do my first install. That included the download of the original ISO file.
Ouch. I downloaded 2 images in the span of maybe 45 minutes.
So I can't say anything nice to you at this point, other than I did get it installed. So what I did was I downloaded it. You have, using the install tool, which I would recommend for enthusiasts, by the way, the option to create a USB install like I did, requires a 3 gig or better stick again, or you could download the ISO file. Now, one of the nice things about that is, as an enthusiast, you're probably going to want to have some sort of media around just in case.
Oh, well, I got the ISO so I could burn it to a DVD, obviously, and use it on the test bench if I ever upgrade for that.
Very handy. So the actual install process itself, for me, on my main machine, which is largely bloated in comparison, took me, let's see, I started at about, I don't know, 9:20, finished it at about 10:06. So, about 45 minutes, I'd say, to get it up and running.
That's not terrible.
And then I was immediately testing it with, what else? You know, a game.
Well, Battlefield, right?
Yeah, you know, the old standby. So I did have some problems, but they were minor. First, when the system finished its final boot, it came up. And now, I don't know that we've talked about this much, but we will at a future date. I have a fancy new LG ultra-wide monitor, and it's gorgeous.
Jelly.
Thank you, Mastrop. But it's because it's an ultra wide, it didn't immediately detect the bandwidth. So it didn't get the right driver, maybe? I don't know. But long story short, it showed up stretched, and that sucks.
Makes everybody look fat.
So I tried to download the latest Windows 10 driver from NVIDIA directly, because that makes sense. And it gave me a weird error. And then I tried to download it using the GeForce Experience, and it said that I already had the latest driver, so I did what any other person would do when they call tech support. I rebooted.
Did that fix it?
It did fix it.
Yeah.
And in fact, ironically, it immediately, when I went into the GeForce experience, it showed the correct driver and the correct resolution, and everything was hunky-dory. So that was problem number one.
Yeah, I had a not-so-similar problem, but was solved by a reboot.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I had a USB stick. I booted the podcast machine up on that, and it said, hey, you want to upgrade? Yeah, sure, let's upgrade. As part of that, you have to enter your product key.
Oh, yeah. You know, I got that on one of my systems, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I saved my product key that I used to install on there. It was a Windows 8, I think it's 8.0 key.
Right.
So I typed that in, and it said, no, we can't verify your key.
No.
Okay, well, maybe this letter's wrong, so I changed it.
What, you didn't have to call India?
No, I didn't.
Oh, lucky.
Entered it again, said, no, I can't verify it. And I did that maybe like 5 or 6 times. And it said, no, we can't verify your key. And I'm like, well, F. So I basically said cancel, and it said, do you want to cancel the upgrade? And I'm like, yes, cancel the upgrade. Canceled, and it said, well, you have to reboot. Rebooted, it came back, and it finished the upgrade.
It's so funny you say that. I installed Windows 10 that night on not just my Surface tablet, great guinea pig, my enthusiast PC, last of course, and my daughter's PC, because why not test there?
Of course.
And on my daughter's, it did the same thing. And in fact, I did the cancel and rebooted, and it wanted to cancel again and rebooted because I couldn't remember which CD key I'd used there. So I had my pile of OS disks. And I finally said, screw this, I'll just reboot to Windows 8 and see which key I used. And it rebooted without the stick installed and finished. So
yeah.
Apparently that's a feature. A famous Microsoft feature.
Yeah, and once you get into Windows, it's already activated, so problem solved.
Yeah, no kidding. So I mentioned my one problem and how minor it was, but I did actually have a problem that annoyed me enough that I stopped, and that was I use CM Storm Cirrus headphones, beautiful 8.1, 7.1, whatever they are, headphones, nice surround sound headphones, but they use a USB external driver. In fact, it uses 2 USB plugs. And Windows could not figure it out. In fact, the sound played very nicely in the background to some nice static.
Ah, that's unfortunate.
So I'm playing Battlefield with static on there. I don't know, audio fog of war, maybe.
Yeah, it's...
And it was not fun.
No.
So I went to download the latest drivers, and oh my gosh, Cooler Master doesn't have any Windows 10 drivers out. Dang it.
Big surprise.
I know. Shocker. Well, and these are still pretty hot headphones, so I'm sure it's just a question of time. So my good advice for my friend Dennis was, I don't know, uninstall the driver and see if the default drivers work. And I said, screw that. I got a pile of headphones. So I pulled out a set of HyperX headphones and plugged them in, and problem solved.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I know. But I do miss my Cooler Master headphones, so I will keep monitoring that. But in the meantime, it's nice to have a pile of hardware sometimes.
Actually, in the meantime, if anyone has some real true 7.1 headphones with multiple drivers in each ear, send them to Hardware Asylum for review.
Dear God, I need them. I need them. But anyway, so let's talk about actual Windows 10. So there's our install stories. Pretty smooth. I mean, honestly, I've had worse problems with almost every operating system I've had in the past, even with clean installs. So in general... He's nodding his head. You can't see that out in radio land. But in general, probably the smoothest install I've ever had, even if it was a little slower than I expected.
Yeah. Thinking back, the smoothest install of Windows ever for me was Windows 98 SE on a 4-drive RAID 0 on a Promise controller. Disk to drive to being able to boot up in like 10 minutes.
Still, that's not... Yeah, I don't miss those days.
Yeah, that was, you know, a lot of effort to have a fast install and then, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, and that's a nice upgrade. Now, I've heard stories, and we were talking about this a little bit off the air, of drivers being reset and, you know, things like that. But all that stuff is sort of expected.
Yeah, well, it's a Windows operating system. They're going to reset your browser. They're going to reset your sound. They want to make sure that when it reboots that first time, everything works.
Yes.
So they're going to reset it to the way that they know actually works.
So I'm enjoying it. Now, I should point out that because I've installed on a tablet and 2 different PCs with very different builds, I feel like I'm a pretty representative sample. Yep. But I do want to point out that the tablet experience is decidedly different than the PC experience.
As it should be.
Yes.
Really. So when I installed Windows 10 on the podcast machine, it defaulted to the desktop mode. Right. So it gives you the semi-traditional, kind of the FU version of a start menu. I would really rather like the classic start menu myself, but
I didn't mind it.
Yeah, you got the tiles off to the side, and then you have like the quick launch, the programs that you access all the time at the very top of it. And right. then a kind of a list that you can get to like all programs, but it's still tiles, but it's a stretched list, so it's a vertical.
But it still had the just type in the name of what the heck you're looking for and we'll tell you what we got.
Yeah, I was trying to find WordPad so I could make some notes, and it couldn't find it, which was crazy. But those things aside, the start menu, having it there is better than pulling up the big tiles in the Metro interface, which is what you can get by just flipping one switch in the preferences to make exactly. it a tablet.
So when I boot up my Surface Pro, it always asks me, because I haven't changed the default, of course,
yep.
whether I want the tablet experience or whether I want to switch to the desktop experience, which is cool. Mm-hmm. I've chosen the tablet experience just so that I can see how it compares. And really, the only difference that I've noticed is that you get the same Windows 8 Metro style default.
Yeah.
And then you can push the start button and get the new start button, which I actually rather like. I think it's a nice compromise between the Windows 7 classic mode, if you will, and the chicklety Windows 8 style with the live tiles.
Yeah. I'm going to have to find the episode where we talked about Windows 8, because I made a prediction about what I wanted in Windows 8, where you would have two modes. You would have like the tablet mode with the tiles, the Metro interface, and then you would have a basic Windows 7 desktop. And I'm going to say Windows 10 brought that, everything like that together. But we just had like two operating system releases in between that didn't work.
Well, it'll definitely be interesting to see what third-party Stardock style companies are doing for their Windows 10 start button mods and see if anybody cares anymore. Yeah. Because I really feel like you can ignore the chiclets in the live tile stuff. And, you know, for all I know, there may be a way to turn it back to text only. It seems like that would be a smart thing to include. I know they've been fighting it.
Yeah.
But I just haven't put a lot of time into it. I mean, it's only 8:04 the night we're recording this, so it's just a few days of playing. And I honestly, other than the little driver sound issue, I like what I see.
Yeah. I've been able to use Windows 10 with the podcast. I've, you know, fired up Audacity, fired up the Focusrite Sapphire software, and everything I needed was right there, fired up, no problem.
Now, a couple of features that they've added that I am kind of looking forward to, I've just touched the surface on, and one is the integrated Cortana, which reminds me a lot of the OK Google experience on my Android phone. Mm-hmm. And I can see how that could be very handy for folks, especially in the tablet environment. I messed with it a little bit, and I found that it was, maybe not as good as Google. And I'm sure folks out there are arguing, well, yeah, but if you've been using the Google for a while, you've trained it.
Yeah.
So we just need to get Cortana and crack the whip on her a little bit to get her trained up to speed. But as a tech-savvy user, maybe not so handy. But for my daughter, for example, that's a great excuse for her to turn on the old webcam, use that live talk, maybe even use the fancy touted non-password login that I have yet to play with.
Yeah. Maybe I can get her to, when we sit down to do the podcast, and it's like, okay, Cortana, podcast time.
Hey,
and have her launch everything for us.
I think there's definitely a lot of potential there. Now, the other thing is there's a lot of integration with the Microsoft Cloud, mm-hmm. which I kind of have been ignoring in the past, but it looks like maybe it might be time to look, because now that I have multiple Windows 10 devices, they will all cloud integrate. And Cortana is a great example. If I remember correctly, Cortana preferences will carry over to all of your different machines, so you only have to train it once.
Yeah.
Same with your clouds. It's a lot like Dropbox, for example, and that's all stuff that I've had better experiences with third-party in the past.
Yeah, that's the cloud-first initiative that Microsoft did.
Exactly, and finally, something that I haven't had a chance to play with, it's got to be in there somewhere, but it isn't real obvious, is the multiple desktop experience that they touted for enthusiast users.
Oh, yeah. The used to download a power tool that would do the multiple desktop.
Yeah. So I don't know if I have that or if that's part of the free build. If it is, it isn't immediately obvious. Mm-hmm. But I know that that's something that we've talked about quite a bit. Sandboxing your stuff, especially when we're doing testing, is going to be huge. That'll save me having to have 15 mouse drivers installed because I've forgotten to uninstall them and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, obviously with the Cortana and the cloud only, there's several people brought up the privacy issues and how when you talk to Cortana, she has free reign of all of your data. And that's the only way that she can accurately work. And when you upload your data and preferences to the cloud, then obviously they're cloud accessible either from other devices or from devices that aren't you if someone hacks in. So there is several articles out there about how to turn on and off certain privacy features.
Yes, especially the Wi-Fi privacy feature.
Yeah, where it shares your Wi-Fi every time you turn it on or something.
Yeah, you got to Google that because it sounds pretty scary, but underneath the hood it may not be so bad.
Yeah, and it's one of those things with a new OS, you need to go through and figure out the different features, just like in a BIOS when you get a new motherboard and you're messing around with it. Get into the OS and start digging around to find out what it is that they have turned on, what it is that you can control. I'm going to say some of the core features that might be a big problem are probably only accessible from the registry, but only people that are really into that and, you know, doing wiresharking and figuring out what's going back and forth, they're going to know what that is. So,
yeah, and you know, it's one of those things where it works with your friends list, and I'm just kind of a little vague on what they're trying to accomplish there.
Well, it's like email Darren, and it would know who that is. That's pretty much what that's after.
That's a good point. Overall, pretty good though. The other main feature we haven't really touched on at all is the new browser. Any thoughts on that?
I haven't even fired it up, so I couldn't tell you.
I'm on it now, and I kind of am used to Chrome, I think, primarily, and it has some Chrome-like features. But overall, first impression, it's better than Explorer.
I think that's pretty accurate. I use Firefox for everything, so.
So let's vote. Upgrade, wait, I'm an upgrade.
I'm going to say upgrade, although I will preface that with I upgraded the podcast machine, but my main desktop is still running Windows 7.
Oh, you Luddite.
Yeah, and I fully intend to purchase, and believe it or not, purchase a Windows 10 Pro license so that I have the actual real key. Just like when you upgrade from 7 to 8, it repurposes your key, so you can never use that key again to install an older operating system. So that's why I did that on the podcast machine, because I figured, well, we're just going to be using it for this. My main desktop, I want to be able to go back and forth if I really need to.
And that's a great point. One really hot tech tip is download that ISO, burn it for each of your machines, and then write the key on the front of it, just like in the old days, and then just stick those in a drawer somewhere just in case. And that's Windows 10, guys. Check it out.
Darren, it's no secret that we record the podcast in Ninja Lane Building 2.
Which is hot tonight.
It's hot. It's summertime.
It's getting hot in here.
Yeah, that's a song, I think. But behind me is a black S10.
It's beautiful.
And it's on jack stands for the most part.
It's not so beautiful, maybe in that way.
Yeah, well, and it's because I pulled the engine out. And in a previous podcast, we talked about like custom stuff that I did to the S10.
Right, like overclocking, only in the real world.
Yeah, well, I overclocked the brakes. It's got Corvette Z06 brakes on it, 6 pistons in the front, 4 pistons in the back.
Crazy.
I know. I got some wheels, custom wheels from Bond Speed. Bond Speed Adams. They're basically custom offset to fit the brakes. They're 19 inches, pretty big. Bought tires for them. You would not believe how difficult it is to get 19-inch tires that fit under an S10.
No.
You basically pay for the opportunity, which kind of adds into the 5 figures that it's under the rolling chassis here.
Oh, my gosh. People are going to wonder how you can even afford to overclock.
I know. It's crazy. And at the same time, the S10, it was kind of it's an extreme, but it didn't come with the V6 automatic. It came with the 4-speed manual, which is kind of, I wanted a manual manual. I would have preferred a V6, but the inline four was more tunable, so to speak. So I had a custom engine built.
Wow. Okay. So yeah. We've talked about this a little bit, and I should point out that there better be pictures to this because you really do need to see this pretty project truck.
Yeah, I can include a few more pictures. So the engine that I had built, and, you know, before anyone says anything, yes, for about the same amount of money, I could have put in a V8, but that creates its own problems, which Darren can rant about all he wants.
That's an old story. We won't go there.
Yeah. So turns out that the engine that they put in this S10 truck was also in the Cavaliers, and the Cavalier is part of the tuner world.
Yes, a great affordable tuner. I had one of those once.
Yeah. Well, you had almost everything.
Ah, too many cars. Yeah. But I digress. So why did we get this engine? What's wrong with the one that came with it?
The one that came with was a bit tired. It was a lease return vehicle, so you never know what goes through there.
Sure.
So I wanted a bit more oomph. So I found a spot online, Chevy Cavalier World, which it's a good store. You talk to a guy named Phil. He sounds like he's really, really old and works in the old school. So Darren and I both know that if you buy speed parts back in the old days, you got to go down to the auto parts place and they would look through a catalog and then basically write up a receipt saying, okay, here's what it is. You give them money and then that's it.
Yes.
These days in the world of Amazon, you're expecting to like fill out an online form. This is what I want. Enter your credit card number. You get an email confirmation saying, yes, you made this purchase. And then in a week or so, you get your parts. Well, in the old school, it's pretty much you talk to them over the phone and you say what this is and they say, oh, well, that's not compatible. Or he upsells you on, hey, get this 7,000 RPM springs instead of the 6,000 RPM.
But you're paying for some expertise there, and that's not a bad thing, especially when it comes to tuning an engine.
Yes, yes. Although the experience was I called and I said, hey, I want this. Okay, cool. That will be about 6 weeks. Is that fine? I'm like, yeah, that's fine. 7 months later, I finally got the motor, which was kind of crazy, but...
I'm sorry, did you say 7 months?
Yeah, I said 7 months.
That's pretty old school.
Yeah, very, very old school. And it supposedly it's typical for a machine shop, if you will. But thing was, it's like there's another place that does stuff for S10s. This is this guy makes turbo kits for the S10, the four-cylinder. He also builds crate motors for the S10. Turns out that the motor that I bought from Chevy Cavalier World was sent down to this guy to build, I didn't want to go with to begin with because the biggest complaint is that he's slow.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, 7 months.
7 months. Now, wow. I got to ask for everyone out there because I'm sure I'm not the only one that thought this, but why wouldn't you just get a big fancy turbo or supercharger or something awesome and large?
Well, when you are doing custom work like this, like a turbo, for instance, if you know anything about a turbo, it's a supercharger powered by your exhaust. So you have piping that goes from the exhaust manifold or header into the turbo, which spins a turbine, which sucks air in through an air filter and then pipes it into the intake manifold. That pretty much wraps completely around your motor because you have pipes, exhaust pipes after they leave the turbo that goes and crosses the motor, blah, blah, blah. The engine becomes a mess of pipes. Basically.
Sure, complicated.
Complicated. If you ever have to work on it or take it to a shop to have it worked on and they have to remove all that piping so they can replace a fan belt, that adds to the maintenance cost. So I would almost be destined to do all of my maintenance myself. I didn't want to go that route primarily because when you add that, you add a lot of maintenance on top of it as well.
Sure, wear and tear.
Wear and tear. Replacing a fan belt, for instance. So I figured that I would just go the traditional, I'm going to build a high compression motor with good flowing heads. You know, I had some custom heads put in there with bigger valves. I had a stage 2 camshaft put in, so it has higher lift, longer duration, so it'll kind of lope a little bit at idle. Again, higher compression pistons, that's supposed to, you know, give it more spark, more RPMs. To go along with that, they made a stroker kit, which adds a little bit more stroke to the piston going up and down, pulls in more air gas mixture. To do that, they offset ground the crank. They put in a custom rod, which was beefy. I saw this thing when they took it apart. And then a custom piston to make sure that the wrist pin was in the right location and stuff like that.
Well, that's a pretty lengthy list. What could go wrong?
Well, I got the motor in January, and it made a crap ton of noise. It just made like a loud ticking noise. The cam didn't lope like it was supposed to. Once you got past 3,000 RPMs, it woke up and it actually ran really good. Given that it was designed to be a race motor, that makes sense to where it would run like that. But it should have the same characteristics all throughout the RPM range.
Sure.
I wasn't getting that. So I last month, I ripped out the motor and took it down to a local machine shop and worked with the guy who built the motor to begin with, saying, I don't want to send it to you because you're going to take effing forever.
Well, and it's expensive. That's a big, heavy thing.
Yeah, it was going to cost me like $700 just to ship it back to the guy.
Wow.
And for that $700, I can have the guy here go and tear it apart and swap pistons for me, which is supposed to fix the noise. And at the same time, I can add the upgraded oil pump like what I wanted and have some other stuff inspected.
Supercharger.
Not so much.
Oh.
So as we record this, the short block should be back together with the flat top pistons, which should raise the compression around 10 to 11 instead of at 9 where they put in dished pistons, which I didn't want to begin with. And that should fix all that stuff, fix all the noise.
So it sounds like there's some lessons learned here. What did you get out of all this?
The lesson learned, and this would apply to anybody doing any sort of custom work to their car, find somebody local. You know, if you need to order parts, have them shipped to you. Find a reputable machine shop, engine builder, somebody that's local to you. Have them ship you all the parts, take it down there, and then have them build the motor for you so that you can go in and actually inspect it yourself. It may take 7 months for that to happen, depending on the quality of the machine shop and how busy they are. You know, good quality machine shops, they have a backlog. That's the name of the game. In my case, I was dealing with an online supplier, which I somewhat trusted online stuff. You know, I'm a world of Amazon, right? But I didn't get the experience I was expecting. I didn't receive a build sheet. I didn't receive a receipt, except for my credit card receipt, saying that I paid him X amount of dollars. It went, and this is buy beware, right? It went to another shop, which I knew existed, but they were the ones that built the motor for me. And that was the whole reason I went with this other company, because I didn't want to deal with them.
So you paid extra overhead that you didn't need to.
Exactly. So I should have just bought the parts, had them shipped to me, take it to the local builder. It might take a couple of months to put the motor together. And it might have cost a little bit more just because of, you know, shipping costs and different price points from each builder. But when I got done, if I had a problem like what I did, I could have taken it back down to the local shop and say, hey, this is making some weird noise. And they would be able to pinpoint what that problem was.
Wow.
So, you know, it, of course, some of these parallels can be corresponding with like computers, for instance. You know, if you have like a guy building you a PC in their garage and you have problems with it, where are you going to take it to have it fixed? Back to the guy in the garage.
Well, exactly.
They may or may not be able to fix it for you. If you go to a place like CyberPower PC and have a computer built, they'll ship it to you, but they have this support structure in place to be able to help you troubleshoot the computer and help you fix stuff. They will even ship you parts.
And a level of expertise that maybe isn't going to be there in your garage builder. Mm-hmm. And believe me, we were just talking about this. There are a lot of Craigslist builders out there. So be careful what you get.
Yeah. So bottom line, I should have a motor in by next podcast. And, you know, maybe if it works out the way it's supposed to be and sounds the way it's supposed to be, well, let's put a microphone by the exhaust pipe.
Absolutely. Because I know this has been a big project. These expensive hobbies, I tell you.
Yeah, but you know, when it's done, it's going to be pretty darn cool. Astute readers of Hardware Asylum will have inevitably noticed the new builds section, which is something that we announced in the last podcast.
That's right.
And right now we have up there just a general build, which is the podcast machine that I kind of embodied into a build.
We talk about that machine a lot, so it's a good opportunity to go out and see what the heck we're talking about.
Yeah, and I followed that up also with a four-way SLI LN2 overclocking system.
Ooh.
Using 980 classified cards.
Nice.
So Darren likes to game. He likes to upgrade computers. He keeps bugging me for parts. I mean, I had to rip the MSI Godlike out of his hands just a few minutes ago.
So. Oh my gosh, what a beautiful board. So let me clarify that a little bit. I do like to upgrade, but one of the things that I pride myself in is building a machine that is still budget conscious. And a lot of that comes from, you know, being a family man and having to find a good opportunity to justify having a good gaming box. Because let's face it, the hardware is still pretty far ahead of the software.
Yes, and it will be for quite a while.
That's right, but there are some technologies that I wanted to take advantage of. And to get that, you need to get newer stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, in the past, I've been quoted as saying, my goal is always to get the bottom end of the newest technology because that sends the budget signal.
Yeah, there's a trend in the upgrade world, and this is something that Darren and I know from way back when we were doing this stuff all the time. When a new technology comes out, usually the generation old, the price drops.
And yes.
That's when you can buy stuff on a budget.
Exactly.
You can also get the bottom end of the series. Like, for instance, in Haswell, we had the Pentium Anniversary Edition, which was a highly overclockable two-core Pentium-style processor.
Yeah, like the old Core 2 Duos.
Hey, and you could get this processor for like $80, if that.
And which then is insane.
And put that on a regular Haswell motherboard, overclock the snot out of it. And for most general applications, two cores is all you really need.
That's true. So. But it's not all the full features. And that's really, these days at least, for me, the only reason to upgrade is to get and take advantage of those no features. And mm-hmm. the biggest feature that I was looking to get involved with was DDR4. That was the primary driver.
Okay.
And I know that DDR4 is kind of not that much faster than DDR3.
At least right now.
Yeah. And it's a new technology and it's kind of still a little overpriced. But my goal was to try to get a platform that would support DDR4 because to me, that's the next benchmark, the next baseline, if you will.
It is the future. It is also going to be supported on Skylake. So.
Yes.
But right now, currently, as we record this podcast, it's the day before some secret launch of like some new processor technology, blah, 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 mm-hmm. NDA. We have the X99.
Excellent. So I picked up an X99A motherboard, which is the latest version, right?
It's the, I think you got the Gaming 7, which yes. is an MSI board.
And it's a beautiful board.
It's very good, very solid. Comes with everything a gamer could possibly want and none of the stuff that a gamer would probably would never use.
That's true. So I'm not paying for stuff that I would sometimes have to get just to stay current, like you
Wi-Fi.
Know, Wi-Fi or water cooling adapters and that kind of junker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the trend has been towards smaller motherboards. Okay. I like a regular size motherboard. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to upgrade my current system, which is a 3770K.
Yep. I believe you're running the Super Mega Ivy Bridge. And you got a Gigabyte motherboard, don't you?
I do. I have the Sniper 3 motherboard, which is a phenomenal motherboard. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would recommend a Sniper board any day. Fantastic. And you're getting a great amount of stuff for the buck. But this time around, because we had a Gaming 7 around, mm-hmm. That was a great opportunity for me to give it a go. And MSI makes a phenomenal and very competitive motherboard as well.
Yep.
Check out the review on hardwareasylum.com.
Link in the show notes.
Ta-da! So anyway, I've got a core system because I'm upgrading my current system. So we don't have to talk about things like power supplies and hard drives and that sort of stuff because all that stuff will upgrade hermit crab style.
Yep.
And
it's incidental.
Yeah, the old parts will get, you know, repurposed, maybe domino into my daughter's machine or maybe another gaming box at the house for the wife or son. But long story short, what I'm looking for is, like always, upgrading the core.
Mm-hmm. So that is processor and memory. These right. are the two things that are going to define your X99 gaming experience.
So I should point out that I used the opportunity, for unrelated reasons, new monitor, to swap from a pair of 770s to a 970. And this was a similar decision. I wanted to have the latest technology in a mm-hmm. video card, and the 970 seems to be the real sweet spot in the modern video cards right now.
Yep.
Not just in price, but in performance as well. Unless you're, of course, in the AMD camp, which is a different story.
Yeah, and then you still don't reach the same level.
Yeah, well, give and take on the features. But anyway, I bought a G-Sync monitor, which is a story for another podcast. And so I was looking for a card that would support that and would have all of the latest features. So I picked up a 970. So
cool.
That leaves us with processor and memory.
Processor and memory. So quick question. Do you plan to run a second or third video card?
Not anytime soon, which means maybe not.
So probably no. All right. So
the theory is that I'd buy a second 970 if they were cheap. But by the time they're cheap, I might be ready for whatever the next big dog is.
Yeah, and that is something that a lot of upgraders fail to recognize when they're putting together a system. So, like, they might go for a 960 thinking, well, I'm going to get a second one before too long and then have the power of a 980. But they never do.
Well, yeah, and the reality is that the two 770s were probably as fast, if not faster, than the 970.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't have the newest feature set, so that was the only reason I needed to upgrade at all.
Exactly. So I have two processors in mind that will fit that motherboard. We have I'm going to probably get the names mangled, but it's the 5820K and the 5930K.
So these are the two entry-level Haswell E's. Well, I guess entry-level maybe isn't the right term for any Haswell E, but the two lower-end Haswell E's.
Right, because we have the 5960X, which is the 8-core one. The two I just mentioned are the 6-core with hyper-threading, basically the same speed, same level 3 cache. Everything is basically the same if you look at the specs.
Right, and that's why I wanted to have this discussion and share it with everyone out there, because I can't be the only one going, why spend $200 extra?
And that is for an extra, 12 lanes of PCI Express bandwidth.
Right, and that's everything?
That's pretty much it.
So what does that buy us? What does that $200 get? Convince me that I don't want just the entry-level Haswell E processor.
Okay, so if you happen to go to Hardware Asylum and look at the MSI Gaming 7 motherboard,
yes,
review, by the way, there is a page in there called the Multi-GPU Index.
Right.
On that page, it talks about the PCI Express lanes and which ones are impacted by a 28-lane processor, and that is going to be the 5820K. If you're going to run more than three graphics cards, then...
More than three, that's... That sounds like a pipe dream for me.
Yeah. Well, if you happen to run more than three graphics cards, you're going to run out of PCI Express bandwidth to run those in SLI. You can get away with three, but at that point, you have one of the cards that has pretty much like four lanes of Express bandwidth, which isn't really enough. So
okay,
for two cards, that low-end chip is perfect.
But wait a minute. Didn't we just talk about in the Godlike review...
Yeah.
Or the Godlike podcast, if you haven't listened to that yet, that there were other reasons to have those extra lanes.
Yes, that was for the M.2 slot. And that's that's something that's not reflected in the multi-GPU index because it's not video cards. But in some particular instances, depending on how the board is designed, the M.2 slot, which is the new SSD standard, basically, that will be going forward.
So I have an MSATA drive that was looking at repurposing for the new machine, possibly.
But MSATA doesn't go on M.2.
Oh, so they're not even compatible.
No. See, MSATA uses... Good. Yeah, MSATA uses the SATA interface, so it goes through the MCP. The M.2 uses... it's a direct PCI Express interface.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets you direct access to the bandwidth on the board. I'm pointing at the table right now because I'm trying to describe this. It's something you can't see on the podcast, but that's where you have compatibility issues as well, because it's a direct interface with the CPU. So the BIOS has to be tuned to support that drive, just like system memory on the computer.
So what you're saying is my motherboard supports this.
Yeah, but you don't have a card for it.
I don't have a card for it. But to be future-proof, which is something I'm always looking for, that's that new features, the reason to upgrade.
You possibly want to go with the 40-lane version of the processor to ensure that your M.2 slot has the most lanes available for the fastest performance.
So when we talk about future, how much future are we talking about? Because Skylake's right around the corner, right?
Mm-hmm. Skylake's around the corner.
And it's not the same technology, not the same socket.
No, that is LGA 1151, I believe. So it's on the same realm as Haswell, so you have limited amount of PCI Express lanes coming out of the CPU. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be running four-way, it'll go through a PLX switch to split those up, so you'll have bandwidth limitations there. The M.2 probably will come off of the MCP or the Southbridge chip, so it won't be impacted by the lanes coming out of the CPU.
Oh, gosh. So basically, it's a short-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
So $200 for a short-term solution. That sounds way less exciting.
Well,
how much performance gain are we getting out of this M2?
Well, quite a bit, actually. It's like, what, 30 or 40 or something like that megabits a second? It's quite fast.
Oh, wow. So it's definitely an improvement over both my mSATA and my external SATA.
Right. But as you mentioned, if you're going to be keeping your current system, mm-hmm. you know, for storage and whatnot, the M.2 isn't going to be that important. If you don't plan to exercise the M.2 slot and get rid of all your other SSDs, then you probably don't need the larger 40-lane CPU. You could get by with the 28-lane one.
So to invoke Computex, for example, I mean, how common are these M.2 devices? Because I certainly haven't seen a lot of them when I've been out hunting.
They're still very new. And as an example of how new they are, you remember a couple of months ago, there was the Intel, I think it was the 730 SSD on a stick, basically.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. That uses the NVMe interface, which is a new SSD interface that goes directly. It's basically you have SSD, NVMe, I think I got that right, into PCI Express.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a card that comes with the MSI Godlike, actually, that plugs into the M.2 slot.
Oh, I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, to give you the NVMe interface, so you can run those drives off of the M.2.
Okay, so yeah, transition plan there.
That gives you SSD compatibility to the M.2, so it doesn't have to be ex-qualified as much. So you have an interface, like a SATA interface.
So I think what I'm hearing is for two video cards, mm-hmm. what I need to do is go out and do some drive research to see if it's really worth the extra couple $100.
For your gaming build, and I have to apologize, we've been kind of a little meandery in this particular build section, but there's a lot of debate here. For your gaming build, if you're not going to exercise the M.2 slot, keep your standard SSD, and you're going to stay less than two video cards, you can use the 28-lane processor and save yourself a couple $100 and spend that somewhere else.
Perfect.
Extra
memory, perhaps.
Possibly. If you wanted to keep yourself future-proof and keep the system maybe for the next 3 years, go ahead and get the 40-lane processor, spend the extra bucks there. And like a year and a half down the road, when you upgrade video cards or something like that, you can swap out your video card, put in a new SSD, you have that compatibility. So it's all based off of budget and how long you plan to keep your system.
Yeah, definitely. And I've noticed that I've been stretching systems a little bit longer these days with the hardware so far ahead.
Yeah, well, 3770K, that's what, 3 years old now?
Yeah, and you know, it's been great. It's only been just recently that I felt like I haven't been able to max out games, and that's really all I care about.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that I sent some research ahead, and if you're out there too, it sounds like a good decision point for you. Future-proof or current? It's really just a couple $100 difference.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS. Follow us on Google or like us on Facebook. This has been an Engine Lane production, copyright 2015. Thanks for listening.